Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are just as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They're milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Betches Media presents.
If you feel depressed and if you feel anxious and you feel confused, you know what? Welcome to the club.
Gazpacho, please.
Oh my God.
What a stupid son of a bitch.
He believes that it's a woman's right, it's a woman's body, and it's her choice.
The Betches Sup Podcast.
Sayonara, sucker.
Hello, I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Elise Morales.
I'm Caitlin Bird.
And this is the Betches Up Podcast, where C-SPAN meets group chat to help you process and laugh at the biggest topics in U.S. news and politics. Today, 2022 is yet another 420 when the federal government has failed to legalize recreational cannabis.
Mm-hmm. Or expunge the records of people who were convicted for using it, which Joe Biden does still have on his campaign website. As something he pledged to do.
Interesting. What a scoop that is.
Scoop. I mean, the scoop is that I saw that on Twitter. So,
yeah.
I figured. So, scoop goes to Twitter.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's one of those things where, like, Chuck Schumer keeps tweeting at Joe Biden to do things that, like, kind of Chuck Schumer should be doing, yes, or also can't. It's like, Chuck and Joe, y'all have the same barriers, but like every other day, Chuck Schumer's like, it's time to legalize weed. It's time to cancel student debt, Joe.
And yeah,
it's like, talk, well, to Kirsten and Manchin. The House passed it. The MORE Act.
Yes. So it's really just in, I wrote about this in the newsletter, but like, it's really just chilling in the Senate. And they said like, they'll take it up maybe at the end of the summer. But it's like, yeah, Chuck, the ball's in your court. You could just try to pass this law.
Right.
Try to pass a law of any kind, really.
Just give it a go. Get caught trying.
Chuck Schumer loves like talking about how other people should be doing his job. Hey, Joe, you know, but to be fair, Joe Biden did run on basically doing Chuck Schumer's job, mm-hmm, where he was like, I'm going to get things through the Senate. I'm going to make things possible. And then he just doesn't show up to stuff. I read this whole thing about how like the Biden administration basically just punted on voting rights. And they kept like just handing it off to a bunch of different senators who were trying really hard. They were doing everything they could to get Manchin on board. You know, they really thought they were going to get close. And then every time he was just Lucy with the fucking football. And it was like, and then they were like, where are you, Joe? And he was like, yeah, I'll come in. We believe in stuff. But, you know, if you vote for Build Back Better, we'll just skip this voting rights thing. And I was like, so, yeah, he's been doing it. I don't know. Chuck. Joe, sit down, hash things out. Do your job, maybe.
Hash them out.
Hash
beautifully
them
done,
out,
Elise.
Indeed.
I mean, you did inspire me because, as you say on the podcast, when we list, you know, three or more terrible people, nightmare blunt rotation, I made a TikTok of my nightmare blunt rotation. I am curious who yours would be and why. I can go first with mine. I obviously chose
Absolutely.
Marjorie was like my number one. She's got nothing to do. There is nothing stopping her from bogarting the blunt. She's on no committees. She only has one Twitter account. I don't want to be near her. Plus, she's going to get paranoid and call the gazpacho police.
Absolutely.
Who's yours, Elise? Nightmare.
Immediate thought, Elon Musk.
Oh, no. Yes.
I just don't think that's going to be fun. I've seen the pictures of him smoking before. So I guess my three, if we're doing like a full blunt rotation, is just Elon Musk, and two, like really huge Elon Musk stands, like Elon Musk and two of his boys. I don't know how I ended up in this situation, but I'm not happy about it. And
not,
I'm trying to
not
leave.
Not happy. My chest feels tight.
I would have one, except that I do not smoke. I'm edibles all the way down. So who would I not want to be stoned around?
That's kind of the interpretation I used as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say, my gosh, DeSantis. He would just be so, it would just be miserable.
I agree.
Think as an experience.
Especially because, like, I repeat this every chance I get. He's 43 and he has the politics of a 100-year-old man, 43 years old, definitely a narc.
I mean, why does the side with so much hate age like milk? We need to have a discussion. Is it because they don't use moisturizer? Like, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm. Definitely not. Definitely not.
Sunscreen use might be off.
Oh, yeah. He's in Florida and probably has like a philosophical aversion to sunscreen, maybe.
I would say that. I mean, he's certainly not buying reef safe sunscreen if he's getting sunscreen at all.
No, Ron DeSantis, if he fails to get elected again, he will start a small business making like sunscreen that is just aggressively bad for the ocean.
Yeah.
And launch it during Earth Month.
Into the ocean directly.
Well, we have at the end of this episode an interview with Stephen Post. He works at Last Prisoner Project, and they're just a great group working to free the 40,000 people still incarcerated for something related to cannabis. And he talks about like all the different scenarios. I mean, for a lot of people, it's like they lived in states where once you got another strike, it ended up that because you had like a $20 joint with you, you are living in prison for the rest of your life, and you were the provider for your family. And there's just so many different types of stories that, not to like moralize about what is good use and bad use, but there's just a lot that people haven't heard about the experiences of people in prison and why they are there. We set a goal to raise $10,000 and we're definitely going to hit it. We're probably going to like exceed it. We just put it up a couple of hours ago. So stick around for that. Also, follow up from yesterday's show, because I'm sure our listeners on the edge of their seats, the doormen did get a contract. New York City is functioning because the doorman workers did get a contract. They agreed not to take away their healthcare benefits or vacation leave, but they didn't really give them much of a raise with inflation. But people are not being asked to take out their trash, which I posted on this on my personal, and one person like very funnily replied like, "Oh wow, New Yorkers would have to take out the trash. What a tragedy."
Well, it is a lot of trash.
It's a system. It is a system.
There's a system in place, and it's not for us to take it out.
There's this really cool like documentary series. It seems like it's a partnership between Cheddar News and the City of New York, where they're just like taking you through how it all works, and it's crazy. It's fascinating. The way that we all get water anywhere blows my mind. It sounds like I've already partaken today.
Have you heard about water? Do you know where our freaking water comes from?
Check out this YouTube video.
Yeah, I saw on YouTube. I watched a YouTube video about water, dude.
All right, we have a couple topics today. First, we're going to start with student loans. After pausing payments on federal student loans once again, the Biden administration has announced a plan to retroactively help millions of federal student loan borrowers who the government has historically failed to deliver properly on with its income-driven repayment plans. What does that mean? So the department estimates that the changes are going to result in immediate debt cancellation for 40,000 borrowers who will now qualify for public service loan forgiveness. It's making a lot of changes to this process. I read through them all. NPR outlined them all, and they all just sounded like mathy and maybe not worth listing out, but if you are potentially impacted by this, I would definitely look into it. But by the end of March, more than 700,000 of the 43 million federal student loan borrowers had to see their outstanding debt discharged under President Joe Biden's plan. So that totaled more than $17 billion in relief. Of course, canceling them seems like what they're moving towards. Seems like they're finding a way to cancel as much debt as possible. And I would just remind them that canceling it is an option.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I don't want to like shake a stick at 40,000 people. Like,
yeah, $17 billion is crazy.
A lot. But part of me is kind of always like, is he saving it for right before the midterm?
I know. Yeah.
Is that what we're looking at? I don't know.
Yeah, it would be very sloppy to do so, because, I mean, it's not going to be like a flip that switches for a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like waiting longer, like you want to for an accomplishment to like hit the political bloodstream. You have to like hype it. You need to have people talking about it. You need to have people, you know, demonstrating how their lives have changed because of it. If you wait till October, like, sure, you can get like a little bit of a boost, but people have already kind of made their decision as to whether or not they're motivated enough to vote, all sorts of other stuff. Because I don't know if this is possible, but like, as it turns out, most people don't give a fuck. I was very surprised by this. Like, they don't pay attention to politics.
Yeah. Turns out.
And they're going to be waiting. If you wait till last minute, they're just going to be like, oh, cool, so I'll feel this in 6 months. It's like,
But would that actually apply in student loan debt forgiveness? Because wouldn't it just be like, oh, great, I can keep on not paying? Or like what in particular would take time to kind of like shake out, to develop the messaging, to record ads with people saying how much this is going to change their life?
I mean, it's huge. First of all, I mean, student loan debt is... it's securitized. It's underneath a giant market.
Oh, right. There's a lot of it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, our financial system apparently loves it, addicted to debt and securitizing debt.
Joe's not just going to Venmo the Department of Education. Yeah.
In order to make sure this is done properly and, you know, doesn't collapse like a portion of the market, which shouldn't exist anyway, but it does. So you kind of have to be sure. It's like you're talking about over $1 trillion. That's a lot of financial impact, which is good. It's good. But they should talk about it. I mean, there's so many people arguing on Twitter, like, no one cares about, you know, student loans. Like, you guys are you're a small fraction of, you know, Americans. And it's like, well, this is nothing to do with that. It's about how we keep asking people to mortgage their future, like literally mortgage size loans for their future. So if you have already have a mortgage on like your brain, you can't buy one for a house. You can't get one for like other things you'd like to do. You can't live a life. You can't participate in society. If everything you do has to be paying off the mortgage to get educated, like, that's what stresses people out, makes it impossible for people to go to college, because they're sitting there thinking, well, there's no point. And then everything requires a bachelor's now for like being a receptionist, which doesn't make any sense. The skill set there has nothing to do with a bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. And taking on thousands of dollars in debt so you can answer phones all day is a waste of everybody's time. So, you know, you can just talk about it that way and then, you know, ease the markets in for this one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If we do it, I just hope we also revisit. It's just like other countries treat education like a more public good. And it's just like, it seems like a racket. Like, let's also address why these schools are asking us for 50 grand a year. That's wild. We got it. They can't be doing this anymore.
Yeah. And it's also like, again, Biden can cancel the loans that the government has something to do with, but there's still the massive issue of privately held student loans, which are like really crushing and really harmful to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of the big changes that they could make, and this would be huge, would be allowing student loan debt to be discharged in bankruptcy without penalty. If you
it's
could,
the only one that can't, right?
That is the big rule change that would ultimately, because that's what maintains the entire market. The fact that you are responsible for loans as a teenager before your brain has developed, that you can't cancel. You can't leave. There's no way to avoid them. You have to make payments. Doesn't matter if you have bankruptcy. Doesn't matter if you die. There are people who get like student loan bills for their children who have passed away.
Oh, God.
This is... It's not logical. You gotta create like a space for people to discharge their debt if it's acquired, you know, at least 5 years ago or something like that, mm-hmm. in bankruptcy, and give them a no penalty on their credit reports.
Yeah, it seems crazy, yeah, that we won't let, you know, loans that people agreed to when they were teenagers, but like people that like whole businessmen can be like, it didn't work out.
Yeah, exactly.
So can you take care of this?
I mean, isn't Purdue Pharma literally declaring bankruptcy now so they don't have to pay people in the opioid epidemic? Like, come on now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you can do whatever you want in corporate bankruptcy. There's so many ways to get out of things. You don't even have to fully dissolve your company. You can literally declare bankruptcy just to discharge all of your debts,
yeah,
handle mm-hmm. all of that, and then stay incorporated and rebuild the business. And you're like,
yeah. So I know, yeah, what I was reading, the like bankruptcy filing or article about it for Brother Jimmy's in New York City. And the owner partially blamed like the failing performance of the New York Knicks because people were going to Madison Square Garden and frequenting the Brother Jimmy's there.
It is very New York to just blame the Knicks.
It was gorgeous. And I said it out loud to my fiance, who's a lawyer, like, isn't this silly? And he was like, I mean, he's explaining the factors that made him not be able to make. But I was like, all right, I got to get into business, I guess. If you can just blame the Knicks for your failing to be profitable. All right, so let's start with yet another horrifying tranche of text to Mark Meadows. I mean, who knew? Mark Meadows' text inbox has to be the most treasonous place since, I'm sure Caitlin would know, some Civil War reference. But there's so much treason in there.
I hope that he has like silent delivery on his phone at least so that he can get a break from some of this stuff, because it seems like the man receives nonstop harassment.
Like, I imagine like the Safdie brothers do like an Uncut Gems, but for Mark Meadows just getting texted constantly.
Text after
chaos,
text after
chaos.
Text of people incriminating him and themselves.
Oh, I would love it. Crazy. So over the weekend, CNN released texts from Senator Mike Lee of Utah and Representative Chip Roy of Texas between the 2020 election and January 6th. This is the normal timeline we're talking about, when I don't think anybody really cared to text Mark Meadows before that. They originally urged, so this is like their evolution on like trying to overturn the election. They probably want you to think it is not that insidious. But now with these texts, I mean, they were getting up to some nonsense. They originally urged Meadows to overturn the election result, seeming to stop offering their support just short of like the insurrection itself. Mike Lee, for example, this is a senator. Senator Mike Lee urged Meadows to exhaust every legal and constitutional remedy at your disposal to change the election result. He kept asking for help getting Sidney Powell in front of the president. Then suddenly Lee changes his tune when, after texting the White House to find examples of fraud, setting the White House up with Sidney Powell to manufacture fraud, Sidney Powell holds that insane press conference with fake news. And then I guess Mike Lee is like, this is too much. So, but then he didn't abandon his efforts. He just shifted his faith towards none other than John Eastman, who came up with the plan to disrupt the Electoral College certification, which a federal judge said a couple of weeks or maybe a month ago was probably a federal crime or just a crime.
Probably
a crime. Lee was in favor. This is what is crazy to me, the way this man justifies this to himself, or seems to. Lee was in favor of states proposing an alternative slate of electors approved by their state legislatures. He himself was calling the states, trying to make this happen. He kept saying in these texts, we need to find a, quote, legitimate alternative slate of electors, which is a double oxymoron. I mean, if Biden won the state, there was not going to be a legitimate alternative slate of electors. As I was doing this outline, I just hate that the term alternative slate of electors is now a phrase in the American consciousness, because like that should never have been a thing we even thought about. All right. He backed off this when no states proposed alternative electors. He was calling them all day and night.
Embarrassing.
Sorry, Mike.
Read the room wrong.
Yeah. I guess we're just going to honor the will of the voters. Eventually, Lee was texting Meadows that he was like, shit, this isn't going to go well. Like, no senator can object to the election result if the White House couldn't provide any legitimate examples of voter fraud. Just a quick aside here. North Carolina state authorities are currently investigating Mark Meadows for voter fraud or for something fraud. They're investigating him for where he registered. He was registered in like North Carolina, but might have voted most recently in Virginia. What's sketchy is that Mark Meadows, a former congressman from North Carolina, he claimed he registered at a mobile home and an address there. But the New York Times discovered he doesn't have a mobile home. And like people have been there, and like Mark Meadows is like a fancy guy. People are like he does not live there. So now North Carolina is trying to figure out why Mark Meadows was appearing to attempt to vote. I don't think he voted there. We'll learn more, but they're looking into it. So the insidious thing about what Mike Lee is doing now, and Chip Roy is sort of like step for step with him along this whole thing. So I'm just gonna talk about Lee. Mike Lee has claimed that he only learned about the plan to disrupt the certification days before the election. That's a lie. That's about when he started being like, oh, I don't think this is going to like actually work out day of. But he pursued this. Lee and Roy both voted to certify the electoral results in favor of Biden. I remember, like I just said, he was like, nobody's going to do this. We know now that more than 100 of their GOP colleagues in both the House and the Senate did not vote for that. And after the violence, Chip Roy, I just thought this was funny, texted Mark Meadows to fix this now.
It's very funny also, like in the middle of the riots, to text like Mark Meadows can't do anything about the mob that attacked the Capitol. Like, he can't even get Trump to do stuff. Like, what do you mean?
I ordered an insurrection, and bizarrely it got here. Like, it's actually way too hot. I got it here way too fast. I ordered a different type of coup.
Yeah. I think that Mike Lee and Chip Roy would probably love for people to think that they backed off right before things became dangerous and things became sedition. But I think it seems, if you read through everything that they did and the role that they played, things escalated because of the ideas that they were promoting.
I mean, yeah. Yes. I mean, if you keep telling people, first of all, even the idea that they came from this place of like, the election needs to be overturned. Like from the moment you hear that announcement, Joe Biden has won the presidency of the United States by the Electoral College. And you say, well, let's figure out how to not have that be true. Use actual processes like, hey, can we fuck with the Electoral College, which is already shitty? Let's fuck with it some more. Let's figure out how to undermine even more the one person, one vote philosophy that doesn't exist at the presidential level, but every other level of our government. Let's continue doing that. It was sedition from the beginning. It feels very much like, what was I going to say? It feels like the articles of secession here, that like some of the states were like, they all got together like, okay, but we need to tell them why we're leaving. You know, that's very, you know, they got together at these conferences and they were like, fuck this Lincoln dude. We're just going to leave the country. There's an election we didn't like. So that means we get to go now. And very similarly, trying to overthrow an election. It's very insurrection-y, you know, it's very treason, you know, I'm getting coup.
The RNC pulling out of the presidential debates, that's giving secession to me, too.
I mean, the good news is they no longer have a platform to spew lies and propaganda. On the other hand, it's a problem because, like, it seems to undermine freedom free society.
Yeah.
You know, I don't need to be accountable to you or my opponent or anybody, really, for the things I say.
Yeah, and it's also like the last guy that you put up made the event so toxic and unwatchable that they had to be canceled. Like, that was you guys. We couldn't even continue doing them last time because your guy was unrestrainable. he could not agree to any terms. He almost purposefully gave people COVID. That was y'all. And then they're like, the Committee on Debates is not doing a good job. I'm like,
there are just completely alternate realities here, which I'm sure we will continue to cover. And next week we'll talk. I want to talk a little bit. Next week we're 6 months out from midterms. So then I want to dive into some polling we're seeing, the actual races, like what's going on, where we should dig our teeth into. Normal people don't really get into this until September, but we're not normal people. So we're going to dig into it next
week. Not here.
Can't wait. Stick around for Million Eyes interview with Stephen Post of Last Prisoner Project.
We all dread the what should we have for dinner question. I know I do. I love a home-cooked meal, but I don't always have the time, energy, or groceries to make it happen. Being able to feast on a delicious meal without the long prep and cook times is what drew me to Home Chef over the other guys. Home Chef's meals are effortless, so I can spend less time trying to be top chef and more time watching it. Whether you prefer classic meal kits with pre-portioned ingredients and easy instructions, speedy recipes ready in less than 30 minutes, oven-ready kits with pre-chopped ingredients, or quick microwave meals that assemble in minutes, Home Chef has you covered for delicious meals without the hassle. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. Home Chef has over 30 options a week and serves a variety of dietary needs, so you never have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. For a limited time, Home Chef is offering our listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your first box. Go to homechef.com/feverdream. That's homechef.com/feverdream for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard that right. Homechef.com/feverdream. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert.
Now we're joined by Stephen Post. He is a campaign strategist with Last Prisoner Project, which works to free nonviolent cannabis offenders and help remove additional barriers to success, while also working to influence drug reform policy and legislation. Thank you so much for joining us on this occasion. It is, of course, 420.
Yes, of course. Thank you for having me.
So we want to sort of like jump right in here. There have always been two worlds when it comes to cannabis consumption, and it seems like those worlds are kind of getting farther apart. There are many people still incarcerated on drug-related offenses, while plenty of people are amassing huge amounts of wealth legally now by selling cannabis. So I was wondering if you could start really kind of broad overview with how many people are currently incarcerated due to the criminalization of marijuana and the and Last Prisoner Project's kind of connection to helping them.
Yeah, so there are over 40,000 folks currently incarcerated for cannabis crimes, both at the state and federal level. And that honestly is an underestimate of that number. It doesn't really include those folks that are in local jails or those that are just arrested for a marijuana offense, which still can go on your record. And so that is a very large number of folks when you think about folks are freely celebrating and enjoying and profiting off this substance. And so we at Last Prisoner Project are a nonprofit organization that's really dedicated to this cannabis-related criminal justice reform. And our goal really is to release every last cannabis prisoner and help rebuild their lives. So it's really important for us that we not only do the legal intervention to get these folks out, but also make sure that their record is cleared and then have all the support and services they need as they reenter society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those numbers are a lot. 40,000 is a lot of people. But I was wondering if you could share some personal stories of people that you're currently working to free. Are there some common themes? I mean, I can think of a very commonality, maybe most of them have. But yeah, you know, maybe, or circumstances that are particularly surprising to people.
Yeah, I think as what you're alluding to, it's really important to call out that this cannabis criminalization has really impacted communities of color the most. Black Americans are arrested at a rate of 3.7 times more than their fellow Americans. And you can see that reflected in the jail population. We work with a lot of different individuals, and a lot of them come from similar backgrounds. And so some of the individuals we work with are currently in New Jersey is one of our big campaigns. We're running a New Jersey clemency campaign. Humberto Ramirez is a father and a husband. And I think the family aspect is something that folks don't really account for all the time, that it's not just this individual that's being lost, but it's a father, it's a husband, it's an uncle, it's a caregiver for their family. And so I think it's really important to remember that. I think one of the other things I really would like to call out is that there's so many laws that really make this such a worse case for some folks. One of the most egregious cases we're working on is down in Louisiana with the case of Kevin Allen. So he is someone who got knocked by the habitual offender laws, so had one or two previous marijuana crimes, and now is sitting in prison for life without parole for only $20 worth of cannabis. And that is just crazy, because folks buy more than that every single day in these legal states. And so those are just some of the stories that I think are really important to highlight.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's the New Jersey thing is, like you said, you're working on it because they're, it's going to be legalized on, which major fail, 421.
Not 20. Oh, no.
It's going to be legal on 421.
So I'm sure nobody in New Jersey will be partaking tomorrow. Not a one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you guys point out a lot of different types of stories, and obviously not to sort of like moralize too much about use because it is recreational legal, but it is so striking how many people have stories of using who are veterans who in many states, like 37 now, it is medically legal, who's in many states, their doctor would say this will help you be in better health. And that could have tipped the scales for them to spending their life in prison. It's so stunning. It's so hard to believe.
One of our constituents, who's actually, thank gosh, out now, Sean Worsley, was a previous veteran and used his medical marijuana for PTSD when he was actually arrested. And so he already had that justification, and yet still our criminal injustice system really still criminalized him, even though he was using that for a medical reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you guys have even highlighted people who were caregivers for spouses who found relief through that. And you just mentioned there are intersections, like even if you are not somebody that uses cannabis, or you still maybe are unsure about the laws. Like, it hits every intersection of so many communities that are already marginalized. Can really, it can just be compounded. So we know that federal lawmakers are considering legislation on legalization. I mean, it feels like they have forever. The House has already most recently did pass a bill to this effect. I'm curious, in you guys' view, what would a bill legalizing cannabis at the federal level need to include in order to repair some of this damage? Because we know it's not enough just to say, okay, you can all buy this now and we're going to raise a bunch of revenue to build sports stadiums. Like, there's got to be something else. We got to fix some of this harm.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you mentioned, the MORE Act, the one that just passed, does do some efforts in terms of resentencing and record expungement. And I know you might be familiar with Senator Schumer's Cannabis Administration Opportunity Act, which pushed to later this year. But I know a lot of folks are looking forward to that as well for some of these provisions. But from our analysis so far, neither of those or none of the federal bills that we've seen so far go far enough in terms of these resentencing and record clearance provisions. What we really need to see is that these incarcerated individuals are released in a very timely fashion, honestly expedited. We need to make sure that these resentencing processes are automatic. So instead of having a petition based or putting all these unnecessary eligibility criteria in place, we really need to make it open and a swift process. And I think it's really important for the federal government, especially, as well as the state governments, as they've been complicit in this, to invest as much time and energy into restoring the full freedoms of these folks as they've invested into criminalizing these folks. And so I think, again, advancing legislation that facilitates automatic expungement of nonviolent cannabis charges, provisions that alleviate the collateral consequences for federal offenses, that's really big because folks get denied licensure, they get denied federal benefits, they get denied all these different things after they've then come out of prison and serving this sentence, and they're continuing to be criminalized. And so I think we're really focused on supporting evidence-based reentry-focused legislation and programs, and we hope that future bills will make the effort to do that.
Yeah, that's such an important point you bring up. Like, you know, if you go to jail for having weed, you can't get food stamps when you get out. Like, stuff like that. You know, that's real things that are needed to reintegrate into society. This one is really interesting to me, but like, by now some states are a few years into licensing programs that prioritize people who have been personally impacted by criminalization. Tell us what lessons we've learned from these programs and how other states who want to restore some justice can set up small business owners for success.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of different ways that different states have done these programs, but Last Prisoner Project doesn't necessarily do a lot of analysis of these social equity programs. While we are supportive of their efforts to ensure that individuals from communities that are disproportionately impacted by cannabis prohibition do have that equitable access to employment and entrepreneurial opportunities in these new regulated markets, our work is really focused on that criminal justice reform part of cannabis policy. But if you are interested in learning more about that social equity issue, we definitely encourage folks to reach out and support nonprofits like Minority Cannabis Business Association and Minorities for Medical Marijuana. But I really would like to take this opportunity to kind of focus on that reentry piece as well. So we really help a lot of these folks as they're coming out and coming back into society be supported. So we offer reentry grants that provide financial support for necessary supplies, family support, even education. That's not just for those individuals coming out, but it's also for their whole families. We also have just started our new reentry partnerships program, which really connects a lot of these folks to those businesses. So even if it's not maybe a license, what the work we're doing right now is trying to connect those folks to jobs so they can get that initial experience in the industry. And so I think it's just really important for us to remember that reentry services are a very necessary and critically needed part of folks if they want to be able to reenter society in a successful way, and especially if they want to enter the cannabis space.
Yeah, it's so powerful that like, even if you are successful in freeing the last prisoner, there's still plenty of work to do because of just the consequences, like Millie said, of going to jail one time, of going to prison one time has a ripple effect on you and every part of your life and your family.
Yeah. And, you know, I know New York State has just like passed something where it's like you can get a license if you or your family. And I know we talked earlier about families, and just it really does impact. Obviously, it's like the caregivers taken away and all of that. But typically, like a lot of these prisons are they're in rural areas. They're in other parts. And like I know when my brother was in prison for marijuana, like, our family would have to pack up the car, drive 5 hours to see, you know, and we're privileged enough that that didn't like harm our finances to do that. But a lot of people don't have that privilege, you know? And yeah, when they get out, it's like the same clothes. You're kind of left in the middle of nowhere. So it's like, it's one really cool that the licensing is happening in that way. But another thing, it's like, it's really important about these reintegration grants. That's so awesome because it is an important part of getting someone back into, and sometimes these licenses are like the only way that people are able to get jobs, mm-hmm. especially if they haven't done the expungement and stuff that y'all are working so hard to get. So
yeah,
I think that's really awesome. Do you know that you're awesome, Steven?
It's not just me doing this work. We got a whole team.
We stand, Steven. We stand, Steven.
We stand, Steven!
I am very curious how you personally got invested or involved in this work. And then to continue from that, how can, you know, I as a enthusiastic cannabis consumer feel very responsible to be part of the solution, but I'm sure our listeners who don't partake do as well. So also just tell us more about what donations like go to and how else people can get involved.
Yeah, I got involved at LPP as this is something that's been my passion for a while.
Really?
I grew up in an urban high school in a neighborhood and saw these disparities firsthand, but it wasn't really until college and in my research that I was able to really focus on cannabis and criminal justice reform, which I had very great opportunities along the way. And I'm just very grateful to be able to work here at Last Prisoner Project. And I would love to share ways that folks can get involved because there's so many necessary actions and support that is needed. Today on 420, we're running our 424 Justice program, and we have a whole website that I can share and link to. And one of the big things we're really trying to focus on is our constituents. It's really hard for them, I think, to see all these folks celebrating and all of these companies making money on the exact thing that put them in prison. And so one of the big things we're trying to do is we have a letter writing campaign. So folks can go online to our website, write a letter, even become a consistent pen pal with some of these folks in prison. And those letters of hope and messages are really strong for them. And we've seen that those are helpful for them to get through that experience. Some of the other ways is really some of the direct actions we have. So for Kevin Allen, we have a whole page that's really focused on getting folks to call, email, and send messages to the DA down in Louisiana and let him free, because there are mechanisms in the law that allow us to do that. And so making sure that we're not waiting for someone to do that is important to us. And putting pressure on those folks that have the ability and power to make these changes is really important. Yeah, and there's so many other actions possible as part of our 420 launch campaign, but also we also have a take action page that has all of these that can be housed throughout the whole entire year. And we're hopeful that support won't just happen around 420, but that folks can give and give their time throughout the whole entire year.
Yes, 420 isn't just a special holiday. We got to be celebrating it every day. And you just gave me, I had like this idea of like, oh, what if I get everyone together and we do like a letter writing campaign? And then I'm like, and then we all smoke weed. I'm like, oh my God, these poor prisoners getting all these high letters. Like,
oh boy. Well, we are going to put a fundraiser on our feed. We're going to ask people to, you know, whatever you paid to partake that day, match it, because it's probably, it varies quite a bit. It seems like the national average might be like $40 to $50, but I calculate it if just 500 people donate $20, we can raise $10,000. And I think we can do, you know, even more. So I'm so excited to hype all of this up tomorrow. Thank you so much, Steven. This was so incredibly informative. And we will definitely want to have you back to stay updated on, you know, if any of these actions change and where we should be putting our emphasis.
Absolutely. Thank you again for having us. And as always, we hope folks who are able to support the Last Prisoner Project and appreciate you for having us on and sharing our message.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks.
Until the end of democracy, I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Elise Morales.
I'm Caitlin Bird.
And this is the Betches Sup Podcast. Bye.
The Betches Sup Podcast is produced by Amanda Duberman, Jorge Morales Pico, and Sean Kilby. Editing by Jorge Morales Pico. Social media by Amanda Duberman. Be sure to follow at Betches_Sup on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And send us your emails to suppod@betches.com.
Betches.